Content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the May 15th, 2015 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. A homegrown terrorist attack in Texas. What happened? The specter of homegrown Islamist terrorism returned to the U.S. this week when two heavily armed gunmen were shot dead as they tried to storm a Prophet Muhammad cartoon contest in Texas. Wearing body armor and wielding assault rifles, the assailants managed to shoot a security guard in the ankle outside the heavily guarded event in Garland, a Dallas suburb, before they were gunned down by a traffic cop. The attackers were identified as Elton Simpson, 30, a Muslim convert who was convicted 5 years ago over plans to join a terrorist group in Somalia, and his 34-year-old roommate in Phoenix, Nadir Sufi, who attended the same mosque. U.S. officials haven't found evidence that the gunmen were actually connected to a terrorist organization, but that they believe they were inspired by the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria and may have sought to contact the group through social media. ISIS called the men soldiers of the caliphate and warned of further attacks on U.S. soil. The event in Garland offered prizes for the best drawings of the Prophet. Many Muslims consider depicting Muhammad sacrilegious. It was organized by the anti-Islam group, the American Freedom Defense Initiative, AFDI, in response to the fatal attack in January on the French satirical newspaper Charlie Hebdo. The AFDI is led by Pamela Geller, the controversial blogger who led opposition in 2010 to proposals for an Islamic center near the World Trade Center site. Freedom of speech is under violent assault, said Geller after the attack. This is war. What the editorial said, were it not for one sharp-shooting traffic cop, this could have been a terrorist slaughter, said USA Today. But why was the event held in the first place? Cartoons mocking the Prophet led to the Charlie Hebdo massacre in Europe, and this gratuitous provocation was bound to encourage copycat attacks. Inciting violence isn't principled or clever when the threat of terrorism hangs over us all. Only fools invite it. Blaming Geller is a mistake, said NationalReview.com. Yes, her event was noxious and provocative, but she was making a point about the importance of freedom of speech. It is potentially offensive speech that requires the most vigorous defense. There's an extraordinary, almost comical irony in the timing of this near tragedy, said the Wall Street Journal. This week, several prominent writers boycotted a PEN America gala over the writing organization's decision to give Charlie Hebdo a Freedom of Expression Award. Perhaps the events in Texas will remind those bien pensant intellectuals of the importance of defending a fundamental principle. In a civilized society, you don't get to murder people who insult or offend you. What the columnist said. Looks like Pamela Geller will get her wish, said Linda Stasi in New York Daily News. More dead Americans at the hands of radical Muslims. This hate monger deliberately provokes extremists in the hope they will respond violently, thus lending credence to her bigoted contention that Islam is inherently dangerous. Other would-be jihadists are probably planning the next attack already. Don't be fooled by Pamela Geller, said Haroon Mogul in CNN.com. She claims she's making a brave stand for free speech, But in reality, she's stoking hatred to polarize America, set people at odds, and alienate Muslims. Sorry, but free speech and anti-Islam hate speech are one and the same, said Rich Lowry in the New York Post. Until all of Islam accepts the premise of a free society, mockery of Islam will remain at the vanguard of the fight for free speech. Yes, self-restraint is important, but it shouldn't be the self-restraint of fear. Perhaps this near miss will shake Americans out of their complacency, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. Al-Qaeda's failure to execute a major follow-up attack on U.S. soil after 9/11 induced a false sense of security. But ISIS has changed the nature of the threat. There are probably more than a couple of potential jihadist murderers out there in our country looking to prove their worth to their foreign role models. And while we're on this page, from the It Wasn't All Bad section, Elvis Summers knows what it means to be neighborly. The Los Angeles man recently put off paying some of his bills in order to build a portable miniature house for a homeless woman who had been sleeping on his block. Known as Smokey, the 60-year-old grandmother has spent a decade living on the streets. Summers bought $500 in supplies and spent 5 days building her a shelter, which has a window, a locking door, and a set of wheels. Since finishing, he's gotten requests for more mini houses, and he's started a fundraiser so he can continue building. Our controversy of the week, Baltimore, the broken promise of upward mobility. The rioters who burned and looted Baltimore last week have good reason to be angry, said Stephen Walters in NationalReview.com. But their rage was directed at the wrong people. The hopelessness and frustration of young black men in Baltimore preceded the tragic death of Freddie Gray, and has its roots not in racism or aggressive policing, but in decades of misguided progressive ideology. Beginning in the 1960s, Democratic politicians tried to help Baltimore's poor by doubling local taxes, building housing projects, and throwing millions at social welfare programs. The Robin Hood approach backfired. Soaring taxes drove middle-class homeowners and businesses from the city, leaving Baltimore without jobs or tax revenues. The federal government has spent $15 trillion in the war on poverty over the past half century, said David Brooks in the New York Times. But in places like Baltimore, that money has mostly served as a cushion, not a ladder. Upward mobility vanished when the social fabric of poor neighborhoods unraveled, leaving young people without stable families or the basic values that middle-class people take for granted. Middle-class values only flourish in an economy that offers middle-class jobs, said Paul Krugman, also in the New York Times. The crumbling of traditional families in our country was a direct result of the disappearance of the well-paid blue-collar jobs that made men marriageable and provided real upward mobility. Technology and globalization have gutted manufacturing and transformed the economy. As a direct result, a child born in modern America is increasingly likely to stay that way. And that's true of poor whites as well. Baltimore lost a staggering 100,000 manufacturing jobs in the second half of the 20th century, most of them to other countries, said Scott Novak in the Baltimore Sun. Today, only about 42% of adults in Freddie Gray's neighborhood are employed. Hard work and determination won't save you if you can't find a job, or if your job pays you so little that you need public benefits to survive. Spare me the victimization, said Larry Elder in RealClearPolitics.com. Baltimore is run by a black mayor, a mostly black city council, and a black police commissioner. 40% of its cops are black. Yet liberals keep telling blacks of their continuing oppression when the real problem is that 70% of black children are born to unwed mothers. Yes, the modern welfare state has made people less poor, said Ross Douthat in NYTimes.com, but it hasn't fixed the underlying problems that cause poverty or helped the poor to thrive. In poor neighborhoods, schools still struggle to educate, families are still fractured, and upward mobility is still out of reach. When I grew up in Baltimore, said John Blake in CNN.com, black men had good blue-collar jobs in the Domino Sugar plant, local businesses, or in industries around the Inner Harbor. Kids played baseball, basketball, and every known sport at the public fields and courts. We had summer jobs and internships. Today, the factories and playing fields are locked behind gates or overgrown with weeds, and the proud working men who served as role models and guardians in the neighborhood have disappeared, replaced by drug dealers. In the Lord of the Flies world on the streets, young men battle for survival and dominance, without the civilizing influence of older men to guide them. If they are to have any chance to escape the forsaken world, they need both fathers and jobs. Well, it was a good week for the long arm of the law. After a convicted killer who escaped prison in 1959 was arrested in Florida. When cops showed him an old photo of himself, Frank Freshwaters, now 79, said, "I haven't seen that guy in a long time." And then he added, "You've got me." It was a good week for hailing a heli after Uber announced plans to add helicopter service during the upcoming Cannes Film Festival. Well-heeled visitors will be able to avoid the notorious traffic while being ferried between hotspots for about $180. It was a good week for gate crashing after a British man named Steve Carruthers snuck past security and nabbed a ringside seat at the Mayweather-Pacquiao fight, then snapped selfies with a man with a who's who of celebrities, including Paris Hilton, Christian Bale, and the boxers themselves. "You've got to have balls to do it," Carruthers said. But it was a bad week for taking a load off after a 91-year-old Canadian woman was issued a $122 ticket because of complaints from a downstairs neighbor who said her rocking chair was too noisy. It was a bad week for answering nature's call after a city councilman in Georgetown, Texas, forgot to turn off his microphone during a bathroom break. Mayor Rachel Johnbrough struggled to stifle her laughs as the chamber room filled with the telltale sounds. And it was a bad week for easy money after a Florida man was arrested for trying to cash a $368 billion check. Jeff Waters said he bought the check for $100 from a man named Tito. "Blame Tito," Waters told police. "I'm as innocent as a schoolgirl." On the briefing page, Russia's propaganda war. Vladimir Putin's government is engaged in a global Orwellian campaign to sow confusion and undermine the West. What is Russia doing? Since it annexed Crimea a year ago, Russia has launched an all-out disinformation campaign on multiple fronts. State-run international news channels and websites such as RT and Sputnik give a pro-Kremlin slant to the real news stories, and spread outright lies and outlandish conspiracy theories. State agencies and private firms employ platoons of bloggers who scour Western and Russian news sites for articles about Russia or Ukraine and swamp them with pro-Kremlin comments. Russian agencies have set up news websites in several East European languages. The order to create this propaganda campaign, on which the Kremlin spends an estimated $600 million a year, came straight from the top. President Vladimir Putin said in 2012 that Russia would develop a matrix of tools and methods to reach foreign policy goals without the use of arms, but by exerting information and other levers of influence. The propaganda is surprisingly successful in sowing confusion. Journalists are taught to report both sides, said Rick Stengel, former managing editor of Time and now a U.S. Undersecretary of State. When the Kremlin says there are no Russian soldiers in Crimea, they have to repeat it. How do you combat someone who just makes stuff up? What tools does the Kremlin use? One primary tool is the television network RT, which was called Russia Today until authorities renamed it to obscure the Russian connection. RT has cable and satellite channels in English, including RT America, which potentially reaches 85 million viewers. It covers current events in the U.S., focusing on police brutality, protests, and poverty. But it also produces wacky segments investigating whether, for example, the CIA created Ebola. Few Americans watch RT, and one of its anchors quit after publicly disavowing the lies that she and others were ordered to tell about the conflict in Ukraine. But the web version, RT.com, does have reach. It became the first news channel to rack up 1 billion views on YouTube. In the past year, the main theme has been the supposed rise of neo-Nazi groups and fascism in Ukraine, making pro-Russian separatists the good guys. How are the stories faked? StopFake, a Ukrainian myth-busting site run by journalism students, has documented hundreds of fake photos spread by Russian news sites and social media. Peter Pomerantsev, a leading authority on Russian propaganda effort, says that stories alleging that Ukrainian fascist gangs trained by NATO had murdered children were popping up all over the sites in early 2014, when Russia was taking over Crimea and fomenting unrest in eastern Ukraine. StopFake traced the photos back to their original sources and found that some were from past Ukrainian conflicts, some were from crime scenes in other countries, and some were actually stills from movies. The group also discovered that Russian news stories were using actors to play weeping or wounded victims and tell tales of Ukrainian government brutality. Russians call this maskirovka, or masquerade, an information war to accompany actual war. What about East European sites? Dozens of pro-Russian news sites have cropped up in the Czech Republic, Slovakia, Hungary, and Bulgaria. Fluently written in the local languages, the sites carry the same kind of faked photos and articles about supposed Ukrainian fascism, as well as skillfully argued analyses extolling Russia's benevolent intentions. Czech counterintelligence has flagged one of the sites, aeronet.cz, as a source of dangerous pro-Russian propaganda. Earlier this year, when a NATO convoy passed through Czech territory, several of these Czech sites reported that the local population was outraged by the incursion of foreign troops. In fact, the convoy was greeted with Czech throngs waving U.S. flags. What do the Kremlin's bloggers do? Russia has a 24-hour troll factory in St. Petersburg, where hundreds of employees work in 12-hour shifts writing pro-Putin comments on Western and Russian news articles, fabricating their own news stories, creating and posting satirical videos, and posting tweets and Facebook updates from fake profiles. They bombard the websites of CNN and the BBC, says one former employee, Murat Burkhardt. One day's assignment, he said, was to assert that NATO troops had been embedded with Ukrainian forces all along. Another was to call President Obama an uncultured monkey for chewing gum during his January visit to India. You work in the Ministry of Truth, which is the Ministry of Lies, and everyone kind of believes in this truth, says Burkhardt. It's Orwell. What's the ultimate goal? To give the Kremlin plausible deniability of its aggressive activities and create sympathy for Russia in the old Soviet bloc, eastern Ukraine, Pomerantsev says. Russia media managed to create a parallel reality where fascists have taken power in Kiev, ethnic Russians in eastern Ukraine are in moral danger, and the CIA is waging a war against Moscow. Russia recently launched a similar campaign in former Soviet Republic Estonia, which had a large ethnic Russian population. In March, Russian language television in Estonia broadcast a faked clip purporting to show Estonian government support for Nazism, a clear attempt to foment another pro-Russian uprising. This is a new idea of war, Pomerantsev says. This is information psychological war with endless subversion. Putin's movie star pals. To bolster Vladimir Putin's cult of personality, the Kremlin cultivates washed-up Western movie stars. Action hero Steven Seagal, for example, is a personal friend of the Russian leader. Both men have black belts in martial arts, and palling around with Seagal helps bolster Putin's ultra-macho image. He is one of the greatest world leaders, if not the greatest world leader alive today, Seagal has said of Putin. On a boxing tour of Russia last year, actor Mickey Rourke wore a Putin t-shirt and said Putin was a real good regular guy. Another Putin admirer, French actor Gérard Depardieu, even accepted Russian citizenship as a way of avoiding French taxes. He has praised the Russian's powerful temperament, adding, "One must be very strong to be Russian." Take a look at a few columns now. First from Ezra Klein at Vox.com. Corruption that causes no scandal. The potential conflicts of interest surrounding the Clinton Foundation are unnerving, said Ezra Klein. But the daily corruption that powers modern political campaigns is much, much worse. With the foundation, there was a possibility that charitable contributions by foreign governments or big bucks donors could also buy unusual access or influence with Hillary, either as Secretary of State or, if she wins in 2016, as president. But with her election campaign, there's no ambiguity about that arrangement. Donors who contribute unlimited millions to Clinton's super PAC very clearly expect to receive access, influence, and a certain measure of power over her administration. It's exactly the same with Republican candidates. They're falling over themselves to curry favor with the Koch brothers, who are organizing a network of donors who plan to spend nearly $1 billion on the 2016 election. Every single one of the major presidential campaigns, in fact, will be fueled largely by wealthy donors with specific policy goals on taxes, regulation, poverty, and entitlement spending, and even foreign relations. Hillary deserves criticism, but so too does the routine corruption at the heart of our politics. Megan Garber at TheAtlantic.com writes, a champion at beating up women. Boxer Floyd Mayweather, already the highest paid athlete on the planet, made at least $180 million from a single fight last weekend. But why, asked Megan Garber, hasn't the evidence that he committed at least 7 brutal physical assaults on 5 different women diminished his reputation, his wealth, or his fame? Mayweather's misogyny is well documented. He pleaded guilty to battery in 2001 after slamming the mother of one of his children in the face with a car door, was found guilty of beating up 2 women at a Las Vegas nightclub in 2003, and made a plea deal after punching the mother of his 3 other children in the head in front of one of the kids. For these crimes, he served a total of 2 months in jail. Mayweather is apparently exempt from the rules governing lesser mortals because he's a franchise who generates enormous amounts of money for boxing and for Nevada. He can now count his riches for his brilliance with his fists, secure in the knowledge that the beatings he gave women will be merely an awkward footnote to his story of greatness and grandeur. And from the United Kingdom, Richard Littlejohn at the Daily Mail, where police solve only thought crimes. British police are too busy pursuing thought crimes to chase robbers, said Richard Littlejohn. In a recent report, Her Majesty's Inspector of Constabulary found that police in many jurisdictions are conspicuously refusing to do the job they're paid for, telling the public to investigate crimes themselves. Burgled or vandalized? It's now your responsibility to find and review closed-circuit TV footage and interview your neighbors before bothering the cops with your petty little problem. Say you found an item of lost property. It's up to you to locate the owner, and if you don't, you could be charged with theft by finding, a ludicrous offense that sounds like something from Monty Python. Meanwhile, instead of solving burglaries, the cops are policing our opinions. In Northern Ireland, they are investigating a parliamentary candidate for hate speech because he said he disapproved of gays raising children. In Kent, they searched the home of a pensioner because he put up posters satirizing local politicians. What have we come to? Investigating people for expressing inappropriate opinions is a fundamental characteristic of a police state, not a democracy. In a real police state, though, at least the cops show up when you call to report a break-in. Turning now to the last word, the slow poisoning of Freddie Gray. Long before Gray died in police custody in Baltimore, said Terrence McCoy, lead poisoning crippled his future. The house where Freddie Gray's life changed forever sits at the end of a long line of abandoned row houses in one of Baltimore's poorest neighborhoods. The interior of that North Carey Street house, cluttered with couches and potted plants, is lacquered in a fresh coat of paint that makes the living room glow. But it wasn't always this way. When Gray lived there between 1992 and 1996, paint chips flaked off the walls and littered the hardwood floor, according to a 2008 lawsuit filed in Baltimore County Circuit Court. The front windowsills shed white strips of paint. It was worst in the front room, Gray recalled years later in a deposition, where he bedded down most nights with his mother. There was a big hole when you go up the steps, Gray recalled in 2009. There was a couple of walls that wasn't painted all the way, peeled. And like the windows, paint was peeling off the windows. Before Gray's controversial death last month while in police custody, which set Baltimore aflame in rioting, his life was defined by failures in the classroom, run-ins with the law, and an inability to focus on anything for very long. Many of those problems began when he was a child and living in this house, according to the 2008 lead poisoning lawsuit filed by Gray and his siblings against the property owner, which resulted in an undisclosed settlement. Reports of Gray's history with lead come at a time when the city and nation are still trying to understand the full ramifications of lead poisoning. Advocates and studies say it can diminish cognitive function, increase aggression, and ultimately exacerbate the cycle of poverty, which is already exceedingly difficult to break. The number of kids that lead has poisoned is difficult to know. That's because the threshold for how much lead a body can safely tolerate has shifted dramatically over the years, as researchers have come to more fully understand lead's dangers. Decades ago, city health officials tested for blood levels that were higher than 20 micrograms of lead per deciliter of blood. But now it's believed that anything higher than 5 micrograms can cripple a child's cognitive development. In 1993, we found that 13,000 kids in Baltimore had been poisoned with lead, but we weren't collecting at the levels that we are today, said Ruth Ann Norton, the executive director of the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning. If we had, we would have found 30,000 poisoned kids. Overall, more than 93,000 cases of lead poisoning have been added to the state's Department of the Environment land registries over the past two decades, a time frame in which Baltimore and other cities have substantially reduced the number of lead-painted houses. A child who is poisoned with lead is 7 times more likely to drop out of school and 6 times more likely to end up in the juvenile justice system, Norton said. She called lead poisoning Baltimore's toxic legacy, a still unfolding tragedy that she said the city has yet to come to terms with. Those same kids who were poisoned decades ago are now adults, and such trauma creates too much of the burden on a community, she said. The burden weighs heaviest in the poorest communities like the Sandtown-Winchester neighborhood in West Baltimore that produced Freddie Gray. Here, most homes were built decades ago, at a time when paint manufacturers hailed lead as a cheap additive. The effect of that lead paint, which Congress effectively banned in 1978, has been profound on Gray's neighborhood. Statistics from 2012 show that more than 7% of all kids younger than 6 had possibly dangerous levels of lead in their blood. Lead poisoning has been especially cruel scourge in African-American communities. Nearly 99.9% of my clients were black, said Saul Kepperman, a Baltimore attorney who says he has litigated more than 4,000 lead poisoning lawsuits in 3 decades. That's the sad fact to life in the ghetto, that the only living conditions people can afford will likely poison their kids. If you only have $250 per month, you're going to get a run-down, dilapidated house where the landlord hasn't inspected it the entire time they've owned it. Residents there and in other poor pockets of Baltimore now reflect on whether their lives would have turned out differently if they hadn't grown up inside houses with lead paint. All these kids that grew up in those houses, they all have ADHD, said Rosalind Brown, who has lived in Gray's neighborhood for decades and now occupies the house he once lived in. They have mood swings. They have anxiety. Like her son, she said. She raised him in a house peppered with shards of paint. He must have eaten some, Brown said, wondering whether she, too, should pursue litigation and try to collect her own lead check. Freddie Gray's path towards such litigation began months after his birth in August 1989. He and his twin sister, Frederica, were born 2 months prematurely to a mother, Gloria Darden, who said in a deposition that she began using heroin when she was 23. He lived in the hospital his first months of life, until he gained 5 pounds. It wasn't long after that he was given the first of many blood tests, court records show. The test came in May 1990, when the family was living in a home on Fulton Avenue in West Baltimore. Even at such a young age, his blood contained more than 10 micrograms of lead per deciliter of blood, double the level at which the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention urges additional testing. 3 months later, his blood had nearly 30 micrograms. And then, in June 1991, when Gray was 22 months old, his blood carried 37 micrograms. "Jesus," gasped Dan Levy, an assistant professor of pediatrics at Johns Hopkins University who has studied the effects of lead poisoning on youths, when told of Gray's levels. The fact that Mr. Gray had those high levels of lead in all likelihood affected his ability to think and to self-regulate, and profoundly affected his cognitive ability to process information. He added, "And the real tragedy of lead is that the damage it does is irreparable." By the time Gray and his family moved into the hovel on North Carey Street that became the subject of the subsequent litigation, the amount of lead in his system had lowered, but he and his sisters began developing problems. His twin, Frederica, developed issues with aggression, Gray said in his 2009 deposition. "She still got problems like that," he said. "She still do. She always was the aggressive one. She liked to fight all of the time and all of that." Equally troubling was the children's performance in the classroom. All three of them were diagnosed with either ADHD or ADD, and Frederica's academic career was riddled with suspensions, court records say. It wasn't any better for Freddie, who never graduated high school and was often absent from his studies either because of truancy or suspensions. And when he was in school, he struggled. "All the schools that I went to, I was in special education," Gray said in the deposition. He ultimately got arrested more than a dozen times. His convictions involving the sale or possession of heroin or marijuana, and eventually served 2 years behind bars. There he learned brick masonry and even harbored ambitions of getting into the trade. But just that seemed a stretch to some. I don't know much about brick masonry because I am not very handy myself, but you know, is he someone that I would want to plan my walkway?" said psychologist Neil Hoffman, who interviewed Gray as part of the lead poisoning lawsuit. "No." The compounding setbacks didn't come as a surprise to pediatrician Levy, who said he has seen numerous kids in Baltimore's ghettos, sometimes called lead kids, whose lives have followed a similar trajectory. Still, the relationship between poverty and lead poisoning remains difficult to parse. Was it the lead poisoning that consigned Gray and his family to a life in the margins? Or would they have ended up there anyway? Those were questions that Brown, who now lives in Gray's old house, mulled over one recent Wednesday afternoon. A local attorney sends her weekly notices alerting her to the dangers of lead poisoning, asking her if she or other residents want to sue over the alleged damage they experienced years ago. "I can see it," she said, recalling the houses she once inhabited. "I was sweeping and mopping up chips of paint all the time," she said. "I believe my anxiety comes from that. We got poisoned." This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in the Washington Post. And an obituary for you this week. The soul legend who sang "Stand By Me," Ben E. King, 1938 to 2015. When Ben E. King first recorded his timeless classic, "Stand By Me," he knew how powerful it was. written for his wife-to-be, Betty, the simple yet moving love song brought him to tears as he sang it. But his producer, Jerry Wexler, was less impressed. "He hated it," King later recalled, "because we'd gone into overtime in the studio with an expensive orchestra." Born in Henderson, North Carolina, King moved to New York as a young man and quickly became entranced with the emerging doo-wop music scene, said the Los Angeles Times. At age 20, he joined a doo-wop outfit called the Five Crowns, which soon became the Drifters. The group enjoyed a string of hits including Save the Last Dance for Me and There Goes My Baby, which hit number two on the U.S. charts in 1959. In 1960, King left the Drifters over a money dispute, and with the invaluable backing of Atlantic Records, he went solo, said TheGuardian.com. His first release, Spanish Harlem, was an instant pop classic, and a few months later he followed it up with Stand By Me. Co-written with renowned songsmith Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller, the track became a number one R&B hit and reached number four in the pop charts. It was later covered by John Lennon, inspired Rob Reiner's 1986 movie of the same title, and was named the fourth most played song on U.S. radio in the 20th century. King had a few minor hits through the 1970s, but he could never recreate the overwhelming success of Stand By Me, said the Washington Post. Nevertheless, King continued performing for decades and never tired of his signature tune. He would keep performing the song, he said, as long as I'm breathing. On the health and science page now, Yellowstone's massive magma bomb. Yellowstone National Park is famous for geysers, hot springs, and bubbling mud pots created by powerful geothermal forces. New research has produced a startling new picture of the origin of those forces, a massive underground chamber of partially molten rock that could fill the Grand Canyon at least 14 times. Scientists have long known that the park lies above a hot spot in Earth's mantle, an underground magma chamber about 6 miles deep. Now they've traced a plume of magma feeding the chamber to a much deeper reservoir that is 4.5 times larger. The discovery gives geologists a more complete picture of the volcanic plumbing in the Yellowstone region, which sits atop an ancient supervolcano that last erupted about 640,000 years ago. It's not expected to erupt again for thousands of years, but when it does blow, it will dwarf any volcanic eruption in human history, including Mount St. Helens and Krakatoa. So much debris will be blown into the atmosphere that skies will darken for years, changing the planet's climate. Not to worry, though. Knowing this doesn't change the odds of this geological time bomb erupting in coming decades. The actual hazard is the same, researcher Robert B. Smith told CNN.com. But now we have a much better understanding of the complete crustal magma system. More frequent heat waves. Blistering heat waves that used to occur just once every 3 years are now happening 4 times more frequently, thanks to human-induced global warming, new research shows. Earth has warmed by 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit since the Industrial Revolution began. Using 25 different climate models, Swiss scientists calculated how the likelihood of extreme weather events has changed in a hotter world. They found global warming responsible for 75% of extreme heat waves and 18% of extreme rainfall, reports the New York Times. Climate change doesn't directly cause any specific weather events, the climatologists say, but warmer air makes heat waves more likely to occur, especially in hotter climates like Texas and California's. Warmer air also absorbs more moisture from the ocean, which can lead to more severe rainstorms and flooding in wetter areas such as the Northeast. People can argue that we had these kind of extremes well before human influence on the climate. We had them centuries ago, said the study's lead author, Eric M. Fisher. And that's correct. But the odds have changed, and we get more of them. If greenhouse gas emissions were to continue at the current pace, the researchers said, heat waves would occur 62 times more frequently by the end of the century, making parts of the country so hot that people wouldn't go outside for weeks at a time. The health scare of the week: air pollution shrinks the brain. Most people know that breathing in air pollution is bad for their lungs, but new research suggests fine particulate matter from cars, trucks, and factories could also have long-term effects on the brain. Over time, exposure to levels of air pollution typically found in urban and suburban areas could actually shrink the brain by 0.32%, the equivalent of about 1 year of aging. The study of 943 healthy older adults found. The finding doesn't prove that air pollution directly causes brain changes, but researchers theorize it may cause inflammation in brain tissues. Living in smog-dense areas was also linked to a 46% increase in the risk for silent strokes, which are associated with cognitive decline and dementia. Long-term exposure to air pollution showed harmful effects on the brain, even at low levels, study author Elisa Wilker tells ScienceTimes.com. Nearly 60% of Americans live in areas with damaging air pollution, says the American Lung Association. On the Talking Points page, Sanders, an honest socialist, joins the race. The anti-Hillary has arrived, said BloombergView.com in an editorial. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, a self-described socialist Democrat, officially announced his bid for the Democratic presidential nomination last week. His chances of stopping Hillary Clinton's coronation are virtually non-existent, but the rumpled 73-year-old will force the presumptive nominee to make and articulate choices on precisely the types of issues she will be most eager to evade, especially her cozy relationship with Wall Street. Maybe so, said Bill Scheer in Politico.com, but there was clearly a certain jubilation in Hillary's tweet welcoming Sanders to the race. That's because, unlike the eloquent populist Senator Elizabeth Warren, Sanders, an old-school left-wing activist, poses no real threat. He calls for a single-payer health care, free college tuition for all, and a breakup of big banks will only prompt reluctant progressives back to Clinton sooner rather than later. Tempting as it is to dismiss Sanders as a crank, said Charles Cook in NationalReview.com, it is hard to imagine a more welcome counterpoint to Clinton's cynical, entitled, and mostly synthetic candidacy. Sanders isn't concerned with how his ideas will poll, and he does not play games with words. In his guileless, entertaining way, Sanders will show voters where the American political left wants to go, said the Wall Street Journal. A two-term senator from the country's most liberal state, Sanders thinks the American economy is fundamentally unfair and that government should tax and spend even more heavily than it already does to balance out incomes. He also wants drastic restrictions on free trade and a defense budget so small that foreign military operations would be all but impossible. Deride him if you like, said Matt Tabia in RollingStone.com. But Sanders is the rarest of Washington animals, a completely honest person. His political power is derived almost entirely from the citizens of Vermont, where he is personally known to a surprisingly enormous number of voters, because the corporate and financial interests backing his Democratic and Republican rivals aren't writing checks to Sanders' campaign, the media does not consider him a serious candidate. When a politician can't be taken seriously unless the super rich approve of him, we should at least admit how much trouble we're in. A second Talking Points article. Chipotle, lots of calories, but no GMOs. Chipotle has earned billions of dollars from making indulgence wholesome, said the Washington Post in an editorial, by touting its fresh ingredients, free-range meat, and classic cooking techniques. The burrito giant makes its foil-wrapped obesity bombs more palatable to health-conscious consumers. But last week, Chipotle took righteous chowing down to a troubling new level, announcing it was no longer using ingredients made with genetically modified organism, GMOs. Now, 88% of scientists think GMOs are completely safe, and no scientific study has found any evidence they hurt human health. Moreover, farmers have effectively been genetically modifying plants and animals through crossbreeding since the dawn of agriculture. Chipotle has nonetheless decided to exploit public ignorance and fear to sell more burritos. Chipotle is right to be skeptical of GMOs, said Dr. David Samadi in the New York Daily News. Techniques by which food companies introduce new DNA into plants to make crops more resistant to disease, drought, and other problems weren't used in the U.S. until the 1990s. So it's way too early to know how eating these engineered foods will affect our bodies in the long term. That's why 50 countries, including Japan, Australia, the UK, and France, require GMO foods to be clearly labeled. Chipotle has made a wise strategic decision, said Virginia Postrel in BloombergView.com. Going GMO-free wasn't easy. Recipes had to be reworked, new suppliers found, more expensive ingredients sourced. But doing so reinforced the perception that this company genuinely cares about the food. Like hell it does, said Julie Kelly and Jeff Steer in NationalReview.com. As Chipotle admits in a disclaimer, the pervasiveness of GMOs in animal feed and corn syrup means most of the chain's meat, dairy, and sodas do in fact contain genetically modified ingredients. In other words, you can eat GMO-free at its restaurants as long as you avoid the pork, chicken, cheese, sour cream, tortillas, and Coke. Sadly, Chipotle's hypocritical PR stunt will have real global consequences. GMOs are a crucial weapon in the fight against global poverty because they allow farmers in developing countries in Africa to grow better yielding, more nutrition, and disease resistant crops. By propagating the myth that GMOs are dangerous, Chipotle will make it harder for researchers to secure funding for further development and innovation. So much for food with integrity. And a few notes here. China has surpassed Mexico as the largest source of new U.S. immigrants. China was the country of origin for 147,000 immigrants in 2013, compared with Mexico at 125,000, according to a new U.S. Census Bureau study. Gun violence now costs Americans an estimated $229 billion a year, including the expense of imprisoning gun offenders, medical treatment for the roughly 31,000 people killed, and 75,000 wounded each year, lost wages, and loss of quality of life among victims and their families. According to an analysis by the Pacific Institute for Research and Evaluation, by the same measure, obesity costs less, $224 billion a year. Californians cut their water usage by just 3.6% in March, compared with the same period in 2013, far short of Governor Jerry Brown's goal of a 25% reduction. As a result, communities will face more severe water restrictions. In the poor Baltimore neighborhoods of Little Italy and Greenmount East, the infant mortality rate is about 20 per 1,000, higher than in the West Bank, Honduras, or Venezuela. The Islamic State of Iraq and Syria has banned its fighters from wearing Nike products, warning of the dangerous foreign words and symbols that non-believers have on our clothes. Another reason for the ban may be that the word Nike in Arabic, when pronounced without the final E, means sexual intercourse. On the poll watch, 42% of Americans now have a negative opinion of Hillary Clinton, up from 36% last month. But among Democratic primary voters, Clinton's favorability score remains 81% positive and just 6% negative. 50% of blacks, but only 39% of whites, think that poverty and lack of opportunity contributed a great deal to the rioting in Baltimore. And we've got time for a couple of quotes at the end of this show. For Mark Twain, 20 years from now, you will be more disappointed by the things that you didn't do than by the ones that you did do. And from Audrey Hepburn, you can tell more about a person by what he says about others than you can by what others say about him. We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138. So long until next time.